Blogging the Boys presents Cowboys Radio with Rabs and McCool. Here are your hosts, Rabble Rouser and Landon McCool.
Hello, howdy, and welcome to another edition of Blogging the Boys Cowboys Radio. I'm Landon McCool, and with me as always is Rabble Rouser. Rabble, 2-0 at a high price, but 2-0 nonetheless. What do you think?
Well, I love the 2-0, but I have to tell you, man, these costly victories are killing me. So let me ask you a question. Would you rather be 2-0 without Romo and Dez or 0-2 and still have both of those guys healthy?
Well, I think if this was non-division, I would definitely like to be 0-2 with Romo and Dez. But since they were both division wins and against the two teams that seemingly, you know, in this early season were the biggest threats for the division lead, I will narrowly take those two wins, but I will do so begrudgingly.
It's a tough one, isn't it?
It really is. So speaking of tough, what do we got ahead of us in this fantastic show?
Well, we've got the great Joey Ikes, who's going to join us to discuss the Cowboys' smackdown of the hated Eagles. And then we'll welcome Gina Thomas from The Falcoholic, the SB Nation Atlanta Falcons site. I think we both admit that we are tremendous fans of the name.
Absolutely.
To talk about the new look Dirty Birds, their exciting win over the Giants, and what to look forward to on Sunday.
Well, that sounds great, but let's first chat about Sunday's win in Philadelphia, if you think that there's anything to talk about. I'm not sure that there's anything to discuss, really. Well, I figured the best part, just to kind of, not to get it out of the way, but let's talk about the good stuff first, I think. Talk to me about your opinion on the defense.
Well, you know, you and I were at camp, and there were a couple of different intellectual kind of exercises we played. I remember one time we were having a post-practice drink, and you know, I think we were talking about what do you think the best position groups, the strongest position groups on this team are? And two of the three or four top position groups that we listed were defensive back and defensive line. And I think a lot of people were really surprised by that at the time. And I know I wrote about that, and people were like, that can't be. They're not good. And in fact, the defensive line and the defensive backs have been very good. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the thing about this defense is even some Cowboys fans are surprised. But the main thing is I think the rest of the league is still, you know, as we are usually with teams that are not our own, the rest of the league is still in 2013 mode. And they're still in the middle of that meme that the Dallas Cowboys have a quote unquote historically bad defense. And I don't think that's remotely the case. I think this is a very, very good defense. And nobody is talking about how good they are.
Yeah, I mean, just looking at who it's missing currently and it's performing at this level. I mean, you know, look, obviously, and we'll get to the Romo part of it and all this stuff and all the injuries. But, you know, I think one thing that's being lost in the storyline of all this is, you know, all the preseason hype surrounding the Eagles and their offense and, you know, and that they were going to come in here and lead the league in scoring and all this. And they've had pretty decent numbers previously. And this seemed like the year where Chip was coming in with his guys. And I mean, that tape, if you're an Eagles fan and you go back and watch that tape, especially the Philly offense versus the Dallas defense, Dallas kicked their ass all up and down the field all day long. I mean, it wasn't even close. Like on the offensive line, I mean, they were in the backfield. There was one play in particular that really I thought summed up the play very well, where they did a play action pass, and we got such quick pressure that an offensive lineman had to adjust. And while Bradford was trying to get away from the line of scrimmage, he trips over his own offensive lineman's mm-hmm. foot and falls down on the ground, and then just kind of wings it sidearm just in desperation before he's murdered to I think it was Sproles out in the flat, I think it was a wide receiver, and just as soon as the ball touches the guy's hands, Sean Lee just absolutely destroys him. And mm-hmm. and just like for what even if he had caught the ball, would have been like a 6-yard loss, but he didn't catch the ball. And it was just such a microcosm for what they were experiencing all day, where just quick pressure, like, you know, just plays being blown up in the backfield, blocking schemes destroyed. I mean, they were just, I think of that, that Stooges song Search and Destroy, like that was playing in Sean Lee's head all day on Sunday. And it was just amazing to watch him get back and the defense get back to a level that's more than respectable, especially considering we didn't have any Randy Gregory, we didn't have any Kraken, we didn't have any McLean. And it's going to be a really exciting when those guys get back.
Really exciting when those guys get back. I think this is a really, really good unit, and it's going to need to be for reasons we'll talk about in a little bit, because you know they're going to have to be dominant in the next month or two.
Okay, before we get into the Romo stuff, let's do talk a little bit about the kicking game, just because there was a lot made of it in the preseason, and I think after two games we can say that it the special teams looks pretty good on certain places. I think you know. Obviously, the punt block for a touchdown is a huge plus. You know, the kick return is, I mean, no one's really returning kicks at this point. Though I will say, great job by Sean Lee on the onside kick to make sure that he recovered it. Of course, it was Sean Lee. Any other thoughts you want to point out? What are your thoughts about Beasley as a punt returner at this point?
So, okay, so those are actually two things. So the first thing I think is that Beasley aside and the punt return team aside, the special teams, to me, and correct me if you think I'm way off base on this, seem like they're better than at any time in recent memory. You know, right now, the Cowboys in two games have given up a total of 23 return yards on both kickoff and punt returns. Mm-hmm. That's pretty awesome. So they're winning the hidden yardage battle by a significant amount every game. The one exception there, of course, is Cole Beasley. And it seems to me, you and I talked about this a little bit before, it seems to me the problem is a lack of decisiveness on Beasley's part. You know, he seems to be catching the ball and going laterally. And everybody, you know, we hear this all the time. Rule number one when you're a punt returner is you get the ball and you go straight up the field as fast as you can because those guys are closing in quickly. And I think one of the kind of corollary effects of this, you know, the collateral damage, so to speak, from his lateral punt return movement is that we're getting an inordinate amount of holding calls because people are trying to block guys who are changing to as Beasley takes it in a direction that no one's anticipating. And these guys can't see them, and so they're just trying to get in front of them, and I think it's resulting in a lot of holding penalties. So not only is he not getting yardage, but oftentimes there's a 10-yard penalty tacked on to, you know, the 1 or 2 yard loss. So that certainly hurt the Cowboys offense and put them behind the eight ball again and again early in the Eagles game. And you know, it's something that I think we both agree has to be ironed out. They've got to get positive yards in the return game, because I think a lot of the games coming up are going to be field position battles in which, you know, those extra 5 yard, 10 yard returns are going to make all the difference. Do you have thoughts about the special teams before we move on?
The only other thing I would add is that I've heard that apparently Lucky Whitehead was posting pictures of him returning punts in practice on his Instagram account. Not that we're using Instagram accounts as reputable news, but I do think it's an interesting thought of, you know, do they trust – it's that balance of do they trust him enough to put him back there versus the need to get – you know, some of those extra hidden yards that you're talking about. I think he clearly is probably more dangerous as a punt returner with the ball in his hands, but the question is getting the ball in his hands. So that's really the only other thing I'd add is it'll be interesting to see if they make a move with Lucky Whitehead in returning, or Dunbar for that matter. Dunbar was, I think, is also maybe the number two punt returner. So it'll be right. Interesting to see if there is a change there. What do we have next before we move on?
Well, let's move on to the big item on the agenda here, which is the Romo injury. Let's start with you. What are your general thoughts about this?
Well, you know, and you and I had a conversation before we had this podcast, and we discussed that one of the things that we wanted to do was to kind of take a cue from the team a little bit, and we don't want to do like a weekly Romo watch, right? Like I feel like with Dez and with Romo in the media, everybody, the national media, obviously the local Dallas media, but it just seems like everybody is, you know, constantly talking about, you know, how long he's going to be out. Oh, well, you know, this guy had this kind of fracture and he was out for this long. And we don't, we want to focus on what the team is going through right now. And maybe Garrett has gotten to us too much, and that's the problem. But we really have made kind of a decision as a podcast to focus on who our quarterback is right now and focus on how they're going to do against our current opponent. and wide receiver too in Dez's case as well. And I think, you know, if there's news to report, of course we'll report it to you. But at the same time, guys, if you're listening to this podcast, you know what the news is. You've heard if there's an update on Romo's status. So we really want to just be about focusing on, how the players that are currently available to us are going to play against our current opponent. And that's probably what we'll spend our time talking about. Having said that, since it just happened, we do obviously have to discuss the impact that this will have on the team going forward and how this shifts the change in the offense. And I think we'll kind of get into that a lot more specific later with Joey, but just kind of, on a very surface level, give me some of your points on what you think we'll see differently with this offense without Dez Bryant and without Romo, and what the game plan for the team overall will be to try to eke out some wins before the Calvary returns.
I will. I want to make one comment, which is to say that I think you're absolutely right in saying we all need to take a cue from the team. And here's several people who were on the flight back have commented that it was not a subdued flight. The team is not saying, woe is us.
Yeah.
We lost our franchise quarterback. What are we going to do? The season is lost. In fact, they were jubilant on the ride home, much like they were last year when they came home from Philadelphia or Seattle, big, big road games against other NFC powers. Romo was jubilant. The whole team had a very upbeat attitude, and that's the attitude they're going to continue to have because they got a big road victory. That was huge. And now they're going to move on to the next team and get a home victory next week, and that's their focus, and that needs to be our focus as well. So how do I think things are going to be different? My answer is I'm not sure things are going to be that much different because the key here in some ways is – obviously, the loss of Romo is huge, but the key here in terms of schematics seems to be in some ways more the loss of Bryant because of what he does to the offense in terms of the way the defenses have to try to account for him. So I think that a lot of the things we talked about last week in terms of what are they going to do without Bryant, especially against the Eagles, good defense, et cetera. And we said at the time, they're going to try to spread teams out. They can't play a vertical game quite as effectively as they used to, so they're going to try to play a horizontal game. I think that they're going to, try to create space that way. And I think also that in some ways plays even more into Whedon's strength. He's got a strong arm, but he seems to also be, the quote unquote check down king. So I think finding space underneath and letting him hit guys where they can maybe run a little bit will be, one of the keys in the passing game. And the other thing I think is they just have to get the running game into the kind of rhythm that they enjoyed last year. We've seen flashes this year. We talked about it last week with the Giants game, and we saw the same sort of incremental flashes in the running game against the Eagles where, on first down and second down, they hand off to Joseph Randall and he'd create a third and two. So this is – what we kept saying was the key to the offensive success last year was these manageable third downs. When they haven't shot themselves in the foot and gotten behind the chains because of turnovers or penalties or some other kind of factor, they've had opportunities to use the running game in similar ways. One of the things that they haven't done, and several people have commented about this, is break the big runs. But in terms of those little, especially against the Eagles, the sort of dirty runs, the fours, the threes, the fives, the sixes, they're still creating those kind of runs. They just can't continue to get themselves out of situations in which those runs are a viable possibility.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that gets lost in all this, too, is that, they ran the ball. I mean, there wasn't any big gains, obviously. There wasn't like any big, huge, wide open rushes, but they ran the ball pretty effectively when they didn't get in their own way, against Philadelphia.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you look at the schematically, there isn't anything wrong with the way that they were running on Sunday, unless there was obviously some occasional plays where Bernardo just, crapped the bed, or you know, I posted a vine of Collins running, you know, wide zone right when the play call was clearly wide zone left, and so he went right when everyone went left. But you know, beyond that, like, I mean, there's nothing schematically wrong with the game. When they're blocking the guys, they're getting the guys on the move and they're getting the seams they want, and Randall is hitting the holes well, and you know, I counted it out, all the wide zone plays that they ran, on all the wide zone plays that Randall ran, he averaged 4 yards a carry, so he's moving the ball. It's just, I think they need to just clean it up a little bit. It'll help a lot to get Leary back just as a consistent presence at the left guard spot. But I think really all they really need to do to kind of adjust between Romo and Whedon is, you know, maybe simplify things a little bit more, as far as simplify some of the play calling. Maybe, you know, if they're going to do package plays, maybe it's just a straightforward run, pass, kill, you know, package or something like that. Or even, you know, hey, we're going to run wide zone, but when you get up to the line, you look at the formation and then you can decide whether you want to go right or left, you know, and something like that. Or it's not, you know, Romo reading the defense and then changing the blocking assignments, the routes, and the backfield, you know, blocking assignments. I think what they'll do is it'll be a lot more of Whedon running the play that's called in the huddle. And you know, I think that's what we're going to see is I think he can execute and run the offense. What I don't think he can do well, what he's not like Romo in, is he can't improv like Romo can. He can't draw the play up in the dirt, as they say, but I mean more like in a Peyton Manning way, where he's at the line, he sees what's happening, oh, we're going to exploit this, and then he changes the play completely. You know, I think it's going to be, if Whedon's changing the play, it's a kill, or it's a predetermined audible of some sort, but it's nothing crazy. And honestly, I that may be kind of what the doctor ordered to a certain degree, kind of get this offense, you know, congealing a little bit. It's just to kind of get the play calls run and just letting your players execute. That's the key for Whedon, is the difference between this offense, I think, last year and this year, is that there are, and you said it, there are guys that we can get the ball out to quickly that are safe plays. You know, a pass to Beasley, a pass to Dunbar, these are mostly safe plays. They're like long handoffs. But the difference is that these guys can get yak. You know, they can do things with the ball in their hands, whereas last year, you know, the other option was to dump it to Murray, and you know, Murray's, we'll talk all about Murray, I'm sure, but Murray's, he's terrible at that. Like, he can catch the ball and he can possibly run over the guy that's standing right there, but he's not making anybody miss, and he's not picking up big gains after a pass unless there's blocking in front of him.
No, certainly not if they require any kind of change of direction.
No, and that's where Beasley and Dunbar will shine, I think. So, and obviously, since we've mentioned it, and just because I don't think there's been enough of it, you know, please, if you have one more point, make it about Romo, because I am so ready to get on to the Eagles tears section of this conversation. I cannot wait to bathe in their sadness, Rabble. So if you have something else about Romo, please bring it up.
Yes, I'm having the bartender fill up our crystal goblets as we speak.
Yes, and I'm sifting.
So yeah,
sifting
I think
it.
The thing about the Romo injury, and this is what I felt immediately after I saw him lie on the, you know, as soon as basically the play was happening, I saw him lying on the ground clutching his shoulder. I went, oh, that's it. You know, you just tell. Mm-hmm. And the thing that ran through my mind was how delicate an NFL season is. And when you think about, you know, like when you and I are at training camp, you get a sense, and it's just a sense. It's not a kind of comprehensive overall or deep, you know, view, but you get a sense of how many people are involved in this entire enterprise. There are hundreds of people at training camp. There's a huge training staff. There's a whole bunch of support staff. There's all these kind of operations people, and all of them are dedicated to one goal, which is to make this the best team possible. Not to mention the players, the coaches, all these, you know, the people who we see all the time.
The obvious people that we are all rooting for.
Exactly,
yes.
Exactly. Yeah. Right? And so, you know, and a thing like this happens, and in many ways, it's a fortune. It's a matter of luck, right? It's a matter of 2 or 3 degrees one way or the other, and he, you know, his shoulder's fine. And And it reminds us again and again how delicate a season is, because, you know, this is a team that's been built so carefully and so painstakingly and so methodically, and their health was like sort of line item number one all throughout camp, and they managed that so carefully. And then in the snap of, you know,
a clavicle,
Jordan Hicks falling on him instead of the ball, suddenly, you know, the something happens. At the same time, I'll say that, as we suggested earlier, the team doesn't seem to be fazed by it at all, which is remarkable, because I have one other point I want to make. So if you'll recall, when we had our deep immersion weekend at training camp, one of the exercises that we engaged in was to rank the roster, the training camp roster, from 1 to 90. And obviously we wouldn't rank it the same right now, but I looked back on that, and I thought, oh yeah, we were actually pretty accurate. You know, I wouldn't change a lot of things. But from that 1 to 90, we are currently missing players who we had ranked 2nd, 4th, 6th, 12th, 13th, 17th, and 25th.
Jeez.
Now, it's possible number 17 will play, because that was Ron Leary.
Mm-hmm.
But and we're also missing like 32 and 34. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there were a lot of guys who we were expecting to make significant, important contributions who are not on the field right now. And so, which is sort of the other side of the look how delicate a season is coin, which is this team is really deep and built, I think very intentionally built, to withstand the very sort of horribly bald fact that a season is so delicate. So if this is, to me, the only team in recent Cowboys memory who could survive such a kind of catastrophic series of injuries.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, you know, speaking of the feeling you talked about when you saw Romo on there, when they announced, you know, kind of a basic timeline for him, and I was like, if he's gonna be back this season, we got a chance. You know, I mean, this team is so, I mean, and this is gonna lead perfectly into our lovely Eagles Schadenfreude moment, but we beat two division teams with half our roster gone. I mean, half our talent gone. It was only close because we allowed it to be close in each of these games. We, like I said, we whooped this team's butt up and down the field. And it was awesome to watch. You know, that's the thing about it that was so amazing, was that we had everything going against us, right? Like, I mean, no Dez. I mean, coming into the game, even before Romo was hurt, no Dez. You know, we have no Leary. We're going into Philadelphia. They're, you know, they came off of tough loss, so everyone assumed that they were going to bounce back. But this team, you know, put its foot on Philly's offensive throat and didn't let up. And, you know, our offense, you know, didn't want to exactly take the game away right away from them. They wanted to give it away a little bit. But once they stopped, you know, shooting themselves in the foot, even after Romo got hurt, we whooped their butt in front of all their fans, you know, in a division game that matters. And now the Eagles are 0-2, and they're facing a very tough New York Jets team next week, and could very well be 0-3 going into next week. So, yeah, I guess the reason I'm bringing this up is that I am dually excited about the fact that we still have a team that can win ball games enough until our great players come back. I really do believe that. And then on top of that, I mean, the thing that you know amplifies that is the fact that the Giants and the Eagles are off to really bad starts so far, and it's may not get immediately better for either team.
And I think before we move on to the Eagles, I think that, you know, one of the other really sort of serendipitous happenstances here is that the two times we played the Redskins, who actually very well may be the team that we find ourselves in a battle for the division crown with, mm-hmm. We play them both times late in the season when we are, in fact, you know, God willing, and that we don't have further injuries, when we're most likely to have all of those special players in the lineup. So that's a bit of a break there as well. So I'll tell you what. You know, you were just talking about how we went in and whipped their butt. And that, I think, is something that I live in Philadelphia, as you know, that nobody here in Philadelphia, other than, you know, me, saw as a remote possibility. And so they had gotten themselves into such a lather by the Eagles' preseason performance that they thought that the second half of the Falcons game, when the offense seemed to right itself, was just going to be a precursor to them steamrolling and, you know, winning the next six games. And the fact that we went in there and absolutely shut them down, you know, where they got four first downs while it mattered, had about 120 yards of total offense before, you know, before we gave up a late drive, it was meaningless, et cetera, I think has them in shock. So I wanted to play a couple clips to you from the next morning, when, you know, all of Philadelphia fandom is still, like, you know, dazed and confused and wondering what the heck is going on. A couple clips from The Mornings with Anthony Gargano, which is on can be found on 97.5 The Fanatic here in Philadelphia. So the first of these, Anthony and his partners in the studio are discussing the loss and venting a little bit on Chip Kelly.
This 0-2 is not a good 0-2. An offensive line that can't block. And your bread and butter, Chip Kelly's supposed to be running the football. And you have a ton of money tied up and they can't run the football. Not only can they not run the football, they can't run the football for positive yards.
No.
Took them all game to get out of negative yards.
No. And I'll tell you this. And listen, I know it's week two and you know, you got to be – it's a long season. It can't – I just keep telling myself – this can't be it for – this can't be the way it's going to be. After 2 weeks, season's over. This can't be it. And I keep telling myself that. And you got to hope that it's not. But, man, that was bad yesterday. And I'm sorry. I apologize to our listeners because I didn't – you know, usually I can see that stuff. I didn't see it coming.
Straight up.
I didn't see that stuff coming. I apologize. I didn't I thought, they're going to win. This got double digits written all over it. Cowboys banged up. You know, offense gets clicking, and they roll. I didn't see it. It was literally a left hook to the jaw.
Just a friendly reminder, Nick Foles has 12 rushing yards. DeMarco Murray has 11. That's on the year. Think about that.
Yeah.
11 yards.
I know.
11.
Well, he struggled to get it out of minus territory.
He should have that on one run.
I mean, you remember the graphics that Fox would periodically show on the screen. You know, the minus 5 yards total rushing, not since 1961, and not since 1978 has this happened, and not since 1842 has that happened.
Yeah. It's only a matter of time before I blow a gasket today. And it just, when do you want me to do it? A little bit later?
Like whenever, right after BNC, maybe, right around 8?
Whatever you want, man.
Yeah, no, because I don't. Cause I
blow your gasket.
I'm gonna tap out at some point. I don't want it to be at 6:33. And Maureen said something to you independently of me saying it to you as well, which was, as much as we hated the Andy Reid, this one's on me. When Chip talks, it's never on him. He's never coming out saying, and if there's ever a loss that you, if as a coach, you take, it's him. He talks about it's on the coaches and it's on the players and blah, 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 blah.
Was that like a wise ass comment?
It's not on the coaches. It's on the coach. Coach. You, Chip. You.
It's so good to listen to them suffer so. I hate to be like that, but it is so good to just see them kind of at a loss of words and start to turn their knives on Chip. It's just, it's awesome. Please tell me you have another one.
I actually do. So a little bit later, they decided to take callers. And
oh,
so
I
have a clip of a couple guys, and this is typical Philadelphia. It's fantastic. So listen to these two callers and what they have to say.
Oh, man.
Let's take a couple phone calls, and then don't forget 50 minutes commercial free coming up next hour. And just do me a favor, everybody. Just, I know you're upset and you want to commiserate. Just try to be quick because we've got tons of people already on the line. Joe, you're going to get us started. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. How you guys doing?
Great.
Listen, I think it's got to be said that, like, you know, Chip was 10-6 2 years in a row. Yeah, great, everything. But he won with Andy's guys. He's got his guys in there now. He's not winning. I mean, I know 0-2 is not the end of the world, but at the same time, they can't do anything. Just nothing.
No, I know. I you know, look.
I mean, I threw up in my mouth so many times yesterday, I still taste it.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Look, I don't know how you held it back. Watch it on offensive line block. And why? How many third and longs, man? How many 1 yard gains on first down or minus two on first down or minus six? Right, Joe?
Our line is terrible. Terrible. You could put O.J. Simpson back there. It doesn't matter. He's not going anywhere.
No, I know. Hang in, Joe. Tony, you're on 97.5 Fanatic. Good morning, Tone.
Hey, good morning. And real fast, I haven't talked to you in 10 years. I just wanted to say how Uncle Carmen's doing.
Uncle Carmen's doing well. Thanks, bro. Tell me you're asking for.
Okay, thank you. Now we get back to this horror show. Hey, I got to be at court at 10 o'clock, so I got one thing going for me. The sad look on my face will not be acting. This is ridiculous, okay? I mean,
hopefully it's just a parking issue.
We went OJ in the first call and court in the second.
See, I told you it'd be pretty good, right?
Oh, man. I mean, they're just going to burn the whole city down after next week. I really do believe that. I just can't wait to turn on the TV and see the city of brotherly love, except for your section where you live, just completely in flames. So it's exciting. Well, we need to bring Joey into this fun for sure. But before we do, I want to make sure that we're plugging Blogging the Boys. It is your one-stop shop for all your Cowboys information. BloggingTheBoys.com is where you need to go. You know, regular season, postseason. If you want to get your injury updates about Romo, Dez, all that stuff, Blogging the Boys is definitely going to have you covered. Make sure you're checking them out. Check out their Facebook page, Blogging the Boys, and follow them on Twitter at Blogging the Boys.
Ladies and germs, assembled Cowboy fans, put your hands together for the great, the one and only, the world-famous Joey Ikes. Joey, welcome.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate it. You are, again, as always, much too kind.
As you all know, Joey was a front-page writer at Blogging the Boys before leaving us for greener pastures. He now sets up his shop in two different tents, at Cowboys HQ and as the Cowboys game day correspondent at Bleacher Report. At both sites, he's been continuing to do his thing, cranking out the internet's best X's and O's-based Cowboys analysis. And as you all know, Joey is my guy. So who better to talk Eagles and the fantastic Eagles aftermath than with this particular man? That's right, nobody. So let's start with the unit that did a lot of the heavy lifting on Sunday, the defense. What did you observe from Rod Marinelli's guys generally? Why were they so successful? And what, if anything, are they doing differently from what we saw last season?
Well, I can answer the last part of that question very quickly, succinctly, and easily, and fully, and basically feel like I'm fully encompassing the reality of the situation. And that's that there's a guy on the field and he's wearing number 50.
Okay.
He's so freaking good. I mean, I was talking to our buddy KD earlier today. I did his podcast earlier today too. And I was talking to him about he's my favorite player on the team. And it's one of those situations where it's like, try not to get too excited, but coming into the season because your guy's back, because I mean, we've heard that story before with this guy, and granted, we're only two games in, but I mean, holy crap. The guy is just, he's not human. I mean, we've all seen the highlights by now. We know the 14 combined tackles and the interception and the pass breakups, and we know all that kind of stuff, but he makes such a huge difference, and I'm so excited, so tentatively excited about the prospect of him and Rolando McClain playing next to one another, because that is just going to be a glorious observing for anyone who enjoys linebacker play. And then the other thing that they're doing really well, that they did okay last year, but they're doing it better this year, is they're covering extremely well, which is an interesting situation considering that their best corner for the last few years is not playing. And yet the guys that are playing very well. Mo Claiborne's had a much better two games than he's had probably throughout the course of the rest of his entire career. Brandon Carr has played better. They've done some things schematically to help these corners with the things that they struggle with, and a lot of that comes back to having that guy we were talking about earlier in the middle of the field, and that's number 50. And so they're covering better, and Sean Lee's playing, and he's playing on the weak side, so he's unblocked a lot, and man, oh man, can he fly the ball when he doesn't have somebody running into him. So I think those are the two things that they're doing significantly better. And against Philly, they just played so darn fast. I mean, it's one of those things where, and we've heard things come out over the course of the week of, oh, they knew what plays were coming. The tendencies are so easy. They only run a certain number of plays. Da, 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 da. Well, they've only run a certain number of plays for the last few years since Chip Kelly's been their head coach, and they've done things very similarly. Sure, there's some formation things and stuff that you can point out, but I mean, ultimately, these guys just did the work coming into the game, and then Sean Lee and Anthony Hitchens and Barry Church played so fast, and then you see him get the ball to the outside to Sproles, and you see Mo Claiborne step up, and he's and then form the cup, as Matt Eberflus calls it, form the cup with Sean Lee or with Anthony Hitchens coming from the inside, and he's got nowhere to go. And they played so sound, they played so fast. And the funny thing is they didn't get a great rush in this game. Not the way they rushed against the Giants was, in my opinion at least, and Landon, and you guys have watched the film as much as I have probably, they rushed much better against the Giants than they did against the Eagles. And part of that's the shortage of defensive ends that they're playing with, true defensive ends that they're playing with, and that kind of stuff right now. But they didn't get the same quality of rush, but they got much better play against the run. And they played just awesome in the back seven. It was extremely fun to watch from a guy who enjoys defensive football.
So one of the things you were just talking about was, you know, Sean Lee. I remember when they first decided to go to the Kiffinelli defense, and, you know, the thing we heard right off the bat was that Bruce Carter was going to be the Will and Sean Lee was going to be the Mike. And I remember thinking, that seems odd to me because it seems like Sean Lee is a kind of natural Will for that particular scheme. And so I was wondering, I mean, you've talked about this a little bit, and you obviously talked about Sean Lee at some length, but I was wondering if you can expound upon the way in which the move from the Mike to the Will has allowed him to maximize his particular gifts. You know, what are we seeing from him now that we didn't necessarily see before, et cetera?
Well, the biggest thing and the kind of the primary qualification for the Will linebacker is that he plays behind the three technique. So whether they're in the under front or the over front, he's playing behind the three technique. So he's not all on the weak side of the formation. That's a common misconception that I've been waving the flag about really since they brought the Kiffinelli defense in. I went and watched the Bears from Marinelli's last season there. It's like, why is Briggs on the strong side? He's the weak linebacker. So I watched it, and he's always behind the three technique. So what it allows that to happen is it keeps the guard from getting up onto the second level on him. Because if you have a nose tackle, for example, like Nick Hayden, who is not exactly an explosive player, he's not a big fat guy, he's not a true nose in that sense, and he's not an explosive up-the-field player, a lot of centers can handle him one-on-one. And so in the run game, if the center's handling the one technique, then that guard has the opportunity to get up to the second level and get to the linebacker. But putting Sean Lee behind the three technique prevents that guard from getting up the field and getting to him. So he winds up basically playing behind a picket fence, so to speak, of the three technique and the defensive end, and he has the opportunity to run to the football. And you're absolutely right about the situation whenever they switch to this defense, and the conversation with Sean Lee's going to play the Mike, Bruce Carter's going to play the Will. And And the reason for that conversation, I was one of the guys who believed that, was Sean Lee was the mind of the defense.
Right.
Just like
right.
he still is. He was the mind of the defense. He was the hive of the defense. And Bruce Carter was the freak athlete. And so you think, oh, you put the really strong, really freaking fast guy at the will linebacker. You put the smart guy at the Mike linebacker, and away you go. And the funny thing is, going back and you watch the 2012 tape of them when they were playing with Rod Marinelli in the 3-4, when those two guys were on the field together, it was Sean Lee that was playing in this will-type role. Because they'll reduce one of the defensive ends under Rob Ryan, which brings them to a three technique. And guess who was playing behind the three technique? It was Sean Lee. So Bruce Carter's filling up against the run, and Sean Lee's running across and making all these tackles. And so it was an interesting situation because they basically flipped roles when they went from the 3-4 to the 4-3. And maybe that's part of what caused Bruce Carter so many problems. I mean, he's continued to have these problems as he's moved on to Tampa Bay, signed a free agent contract, and has been replaced by a mid-round rookie in his time there. So I don't think it's isolated to that cause. But they essentially switched roles, and you're absolutely right in that you look back now in hindsight, of course, at least for me, as one of the guys who was preaching Sean as the Mike and Carter was the Will, was that those two guys had the opposite roles in the 3-4, and that Sean Lee is a perfect fit, height, weight, speed, instinct kind of guy to play the Will, and he's showing it through two games for sure.
I'll tell you one other reason I felt that way at the time was because if you remember, one of Derek Brooks's particular marks of genius was his ability to play the sort of underneath zones in the passing game, where he'd sort of take a step toward one guy, and then if there was like sort of a shallow cross, he had this sort of ability to psych or fake quarterbacks out and like, you know, get underneath those sort of shallow routes and get a lot of interceptions as a result. And, you know, we've seen Lee, when he was a 3-4 linebacker, do that a lot. And so I thought, you know, if Lee was put in that same sort of set of coverage responsibilities in the new 4-3, that he might be able to exploit that particular gift that he has as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing about you play that, if you go back to the very, very deep roots of this Rod Marinelli, Monty Kiffin defense and the Tampa 2 and what they did when they were in Tampa Bay, and in that weak side linebacker, that Will linebacker, when they're playing the under front, which was their base, so he's on the true weak side, he's on the opposite side of the tight end. And so these tight ends are running these underneath routes, these crossing routes, and these routes that stop in the middle of the field, and that just sits there, and it creates the opportunity for that weak side linebacker to play underneath a lot of those routes as they come across the field, exactly like you're talking about. And again, hindsight for me, and you were much more reticent to it than I was at the time. Hindsight for me, it's a perfect, absolute perfect fit. And I think that the concern about playing it the other way was the concern that about Bruce Carter having the aptitude to play the middle linebacker position,
right,
as you kind of, again, hindsight benefits us all, but him having the mental aptitude or the mental, I don't know what the right word is.
You're acumen?
There you go.
Capacity?
The mental, exactly. All of the above.
All right, so continuing this idea, I'd love to hear your thoughts on a couple of young defensive backs who caught my eye when watching the game, Tyler Patman and Byron Jones. They both seem to be in the correct position and making plays at times, which was really great to see with young defensive backs. And what did you see from them, and what did they do to help the Cowboys control the middle of the field that Chip Kelly likes to exploit in the passing game?
Well, I think that a couple of things stood out, and that is that two of the Eagles' better weapons in the passing game are the tight end, Zach Ertz, and the slot receiver, Jordan Matthews. So you're immediately placing these two young players, as you said, very relatively inexperienced players, in positions in large roles to stop this Eagles' offense. And Byron Jones took Zach Ertz's lunch money all day long.
It was embarrassing, frankly.
It really was. I mean, and the way that the term that I used for Byron Jones through the entire draft season was that he was a bully at the line of scrimmage to these American Athletic Conference Conference USA type opponents that he was playing in college. And he turned it into, I mean, on one of the pass plays, there's a pass play to Miles Austin that Tyler Patman actually broke up, made a great play on the ball.
Right.
He broke the play up. But if you watch Byron Jones cover Zach Ertz on that play, he rides him down the field for about 3 yards and then puts him on the ground in the middle of the route, 5 yards down the field, like mm-hmm. still within the little 5 yard, it's legal to touch you box. And he just rides him and just drops him on the ground and stands over him. Like mm-hmm. He literally bullied this 6 foot, whatever, 245 or 250 pound tight end and made him look like a small little slot receiver. So he was very good. Like I said, he took his lunch money all day long. He was physical with him. He was right in his hip pocket. He made the play that resulted in the J.J. Wilcox interception, getting his hand in on the ball, knocked in, played very, very well. And then Tyler Patman played pretty darn well himself. Again, he made the play on Miles Austin. He was in place to make a couple of plays on Jordan Matthews. They played on the inside with two-way goes, which are very difficult. The Eagles run a lot of these kind of over deep crossing routes with Jordan Matthews out of the slot, where he winds up really deep on way on the other side of the field. And mm-hmm. and that's a long darn way for a slot cornerback to run with a wide receiver like Jordan Matthews. And he was there pretty consistently. Towards the end of the game, Matthews started to get open a little bit more, but you could kind of tell the Cowboys were leaving a little bit more space, trying, you know, just especially the garbage time drive after it was 20-3 and the Eagles drive down and wind up scoring a touchdown. But I mean, overall, you have to be extremely pleased with the way that those two guys have played. And like I said a minute ago, your best cornerback is the guy that's played inside for you for the last couple of years, and he's not playing right now. And I don't think you've missed him all that much. Mm-hmm. So that says something. And you've got another veteran guy in Corey White who can kind of play those same kind of roles, and he hasn't seen the field.
He hadn't even seen the field.
Exactly.
Yet.
He can't get on the field because these two young kids are playing so good. So, I mean, you just have to be ecstatic about the way those two guys are playing, because that's a big part of this defense. I mean, you think about some of the guys that they're going to have to play against. They've got the tight end. They've got Rob Gronkowski coming in a few weeks. And I said this week that I'm really excited to watch that matchup with Byron Jones. Not because I think Byron Jones is going to shut Rob Gronkowski down. That doesn't happen. But just because the Cowboys have a guy that's in that 6 foot, 200 and something pound range of size with the athleticism that Jones has to be able to go up and get the ball when he has to, and with the cover skills of a cornerback, but the size of a safety to be able to match up and go outside the numbers with Gronkowski whenever he goes out there and lines up outside. They don't have to send a linebacker out there with him. They send Byron Jones out there with him, and they can cause problems. That's not the same mismatch as when he runs out there and the Bills run their middle linebacker out there. It's not the same mismatch. So I'm very, very, very excited about the play of those two guys on the inside for sure.
The crazy thing about that too is that, I mean, a lot of the talk all week, and you heard Brian Broaddus talk about it on the Cowboys website, is, you know, there were concerns about these guys getting lined up. You know, I mean, that's what people were talking about, whether these guys were going to get lined up enough, you know, well enough to cover these plays. And you know, going back and watching the tape on these kids, like, I mean, they're passing off bunch releases without any problems. Patman made this beautiful exchange on his inside man did a wheel route, and then the outside man came in and just did like a stop and passed it off perfectly, and then made a play on the ball. Like, I mean, it's just crazy, like, how vet like these two young players who, I've never seen an NFL snap before, just came in and having no problem kind of picking up some of these, you know, more complicated releases and switches and exchanges. It's just it's really impressive.
Absolutely. And it's like, you think about, I mean, I'm gonna go a little red ball on you here. You think about the kind of guy that you're playing with in there. You talk about Byron Jones, and we talked plenty about him before the draft, the kind of guy he is, the intelligence, the mental aptitude, all the things we talked about Bruce Carter struggling with a few minutes ago. It's the exact opposite of this guy that wears 31. And then you think about Tyler Patman, who made this gigantic play in a preseason game, granted, where he saw the play, read the play, jumped the route on the ball, made an interception, scored a touchdown, and comes out after the game and is like, yeah, I saw that on film. Mm-hmm. And you're like, you're watching film on preseason, and it was a new offensive system for the Dolphins. So he's watching preseason film of the Dolphins before he goes out there and plays in this game, and he makes that kind of play. So you're talking about guys that study, guys that do the right thing off the field, in the film room to get ready for the game. I was not nearly as concerned about that kind of stuff as you said, Broaddus and some of these other guys were leading into the game.
So it's unfortunately now time to turn to the unit that has not been playing quite as well. I think this is probably the unit that struggled the most so far, and that's the offense. Since it starts up front, let's begin with the big uglies on the O-line. They appear to have some trouble against the Eagles' front seven, and there was a little bit of struggle against the Giants, but I think far less. I think they're probably for different reasons. Is this a fair assessment? And if so, what is contributing to their malaise, so to speak?
Well, one thing that I noticed is, well, I think the first thing you have to say is that the Eagles have a darn good front.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think you got to give those guys credit where some of the credit is due. Fletcher Cox, Benny Logan, all of those inside linebackers, two of which wound up hurt and out of the game. And Vinnie Curry's probably the most underrated defensive holder in the league. That's the line that Landon gave me earlier this week. And Connor Barwin's a good player. Brandon Graham's a guy we were trying to convince Dallas to sign during the offseason. So these guys are good players. So you got to give those guys credit. One of the other things that you notice is these guys aren't cutting on the backside on the outside zone, which is like a staple of this play. Is you're used to seeing those backside linemen just chop people down, and they're not doing that. And it's one of the things that you see these backs try to cut up on the outside zone, and the lane's not there. And part of it, in my opinion, is because they're not cutting those backside guys down. Because some of these reach blocks that you ask these linemen to make on the backside are not human blocks. They're not things that Tyron Smith is a freak and Zach Martin is a freak, but those guys are humans, kind of. And so to ask those guys to ask Tyron Smith to reach block a three technique on an outside zone play going the other way and to do it without cutting him is extremely difficult. And so you wind up seeing these guys not have the kind of lanes that they're used to having whenever they cut up the field. So for me, that's part of the issue. And another part of it is these guys really haven't played together all that much. Mm-hmm. And you could go and extend that and just say, well, Mackenzie Bernardo wasn't very good in the game. and Lyle Collins played better than Mackenzie Bernardo. But and Landon tweeted the Vine, I think it was last night, where Lyle Collins goes right, the whole rest of the offensive line goes left, and the defensive end just goes straight up the field and tackles Darren McFadden in the backfield.
Actually, to his credit, he didn't get tackled in the backfield. He managed to break the tackle and actually pick up 6 yards. So kudos to McFadden.
There's a first time for everything.
Exactly.
It's these kinds of things that go on that last year, this kind of stuff wasn't happening. And so who knows, maybe it's a few weeks in, Ron Leary comes back or Lyle Collins keeps playing or they settle that left guard spot. That's kind of been a question mark for most of the offseason since Lyle Collins signed. Ron Leary kind of answered a lot of those questions in camp, but Lyle Collins has just continued to progress and continued to get better and continued to do well. And he did a pretty darn good job passing off the stunts and handling the games and the things up front. It was Mackenzie Bernardo that didn't handle the twist dog that Philly ran that wound up getting Tony Romo hurt. Right. It was Mackenzie Bernardo that didn't pass that guy off to Frederick and go get Hicks as he came across. It was the veteran guy that didn't make that move. So they'll get that left guard spot settled. They'll get things rolling. I tweeted at Brian Broaddus this week. You mentioned him earlier. People joke that he looks a lot like Frank Pollock. So I tweeted out a request to Brian Broaddus for somebody to tell Broaddus to tell his brother that they need to start cutting guys down on the backside of the zone play. So hopefully we see that this week and they'll be better off running the ball. And it's just pass protection's been good. I mean, with the one or two exceptions, they missed a twist stunt early in the game that Zach Martin got held by your guy Vinnie Curry, and you know those kind of things happen. But overall, the protection's been really good, other than the one freak play where Tony fumbles the ball on his own because Malcolm Jenkins jumps the slant route that that Cole Beasley was supposed to be running, although he didn't really run it, and mm-hmm. you can go into all that kind of stuff, but. Overall, the protection's been good. It took a freak play to get Tony hurt and a really, really late hit to get him kind of banged up in the first game. And so you can't complain too much about the protection, but they've got to do better blocking it up for the run for sure.
So I know we're going to talk about a little bit more about the running game in a second, but do you have any sense of why they're not cutting on the backside?
I have no idea.
Do you think that's is that a schematic principle they've adopted now? And you know, now that Pollock is the OL coach, or you think it's something they're going to build back in, or like, why would they do that?
I have no idea, because literally every teaching tape you watch, every clinic talk you watch about the outside zone play, about the zone play, it is all about you get out there and you chop these guys down on the backside.
So I was wondering, though, because this is something that I was trying to figure out. Was there a point when they completely outlawed the cut blocks?
I don't believe so, because I know that – I say that they're not doing it. They're not doing it nearly as consistently as they have in the past. I know that they kind of outlaw the little thing that they used to do where they just dive in front of them and then roll – where mm-hmm. even if they missed them, they'd roll into them. I know that they kind of took that away. But, I mean, they haven't taken away just a straight cut, because I saw Zach Martin do it to a defensive tackle on the Giants last week on tape. They just didn't do it against Philly. And maybe it's a 3-4 thing. Who knows? Mm. And one of the things we've kind of talked about as a narrative throughout the course of the last 2 years is this offensive line hasn't played that great against 3-4 teams. So maybe that's the trend, and we've only played 1-4-3 and 1-3-4 team this year, so we don't know. But maybe it's the difference in the front, or maybe it's the matchup or something like that. But I don't like it very much. so we'll see how it goes from there, because, you know, my opinion means about as much as the penny you find on the side of the road when it comes to what they actually do. But it makes me not happy. It makes me put a frowny face on whenever I see those guys not cutting guys on the backside.
I'm sorry, is it me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Way to go, Landon.
Man, that's my bad. Well, we swapped these. So.
We swapped. Yeah.
I noticed. Yeah. I was like, wait a second, that doesn't sound like Ravel.
You want to give a little pause for pickup?
Yeah, yeah. All right, so a closely related question to this is the current state of the running game and your opinion on it. So, oh, Jesus Christ, dude, that was... All right, give me a second. Sorry. Yeah. All right, so a closely related question. Give us your assessment of the current state of the Cowboys running game, and specifically, how are the various running backs acquitting themselves?
Well, I think that, we talked a lot about how they're blocking it up and stuff. So if you talk about the actual running backs, you're going to hear a lot of people saying right now, well, Joseph Randall's not the guy. Joseph Randall hasn't made the runs that DeMarco Murray made last year, because he clearly isn't making them this year. But the runs that Murray made last year, Randall's not making. He's getting what's blocked and nothing else is something you'll hear, which if you watch the game against Philadelphia, and you listen to the head coach talk, there were – 5 or 6 or 7 runs that were blocked for -2 and he turns into 4 or 5, or they're blocked for -6 and he turns it into 2, or it's blocked for 0 and he gets 4. And so he's adding value to the run game, if you want to call it that way. But they just haven't had the big run. That's really what's missing.
Yep.
From what happened last year to what's happening this year. And a big part of that, in my opinion, is the thing we talked about a few minutes ago, where they're not cutting guys on the backside, so the cut-up lane isn't there to get in and go. But again, that's water under the bridge at this point. We've talked about that enough. But he's done a good enough job, in my opinion, for his role to not change. the guy that I have a different opinion about, and you'll get people who will completely disagree with me and scream that he's the best back on the team, is Darren McFadden. And he's getting like 8 to 10 carries a game, and he's averaging 2 or 3 yards a carry. I mean, if a guy is averaging 3 or 4 yards a carry on 16 or 20 carries, then that's one thing. His volume, I mean, he's going to wind up busting some carries. But this guy that gets 8 to 10 carries in a game, to me, I want that guy to be a guy that's going to bust a 20-yarder in those 8 carries. I mean, that was the Joseph Randall role last year, where you come in, right, you get a handful of carries in the game, and you got to do something with them. I mean, and he hasn't done that to this point. And the thing that's interesting to me is the kind of runner that he is. He's the kind of guy that he's a long runway kind of guy. It takes him a while to get going, and he's got to be doing it in a straight line. And so the kind of run they're running the outside zone with him as much as they're running it with Randall, and they're not giving him those straight and. When you run the outside zone, there's 3 or 4 possibilities of where the run goes. Only one of them is that straight line path that gives you the long runway to get going. And you're dependent upon what the defense does to make you read that track and run that track. And it's probably the most rare of the 3 or 4 tracks for you to actually do. So not a great fit, in other words, is what I'm trying to get at. But if you talk about him on some of the sweep stuff and some of the power runs where you get a guy in front of him and it's a two-way go and it's a 15-degree turn here or a 15-degree turn there and he can really get up to speed and get going, those are the kind of runs you want to see him on, and they're not doing those with him. So just my opinion, and maybe I'm too – maybe I'm being an A&M homer. Maybe I'm being too – focused on the athletic measurable traits. I want to see Christian Michael get a shot at this thing. Darren McFadden is not adding enough value in the run game or the pass game from a protection standpoint or a receiving game standpoint or a running game standpoint for me to say I have to have Darren McFadden active on game day. Whenever I can... If I can put Christian Michael in the backfield and give the guy 8 to 10 carries for one or two games, because what I don't remember the condition on the trade. It was what, 3 games? Mm-hmm. If he's on the 46 for 3 games,
I think it was 3. Yeah.
Yeah. So you put I'd put him active for 2 games. I'd give him 10 carries in the first game, and I'd give him 15 in the second, and see what he does with him. And if he does nothing with him, then I'd just cut him. So you don't have to give up the pick. And go from there.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just me and trying to – I'm probably thinking too many layers deep into this thing. They're clearly concerned about winning this year. They're going out and trading for Matt Cassel and restructuring a million-year-old Jason Witten's contract to be able to have enough room to be able to operate safely after taking on the extra money from the quarterback and the wide receiver and the running back that they've traded for, these sorts of things. And so they're clearly – not all in, so to speak, but they're clearly focused on trying to make sure that they stay a contender this year until they kind of get the cavalry back throughout the course of the year. And so for me, I would run Christian Michael out there and give him a shot, because he's the one guy on this team, in my opinion, at the running back position that has the possibility to completely change and completely alter their plans for the position. Mm-hmm. Because if you give the guy 10 carries, he may go 80 yards on those 10 carries. And he won't do it with a 70-yard carry and 8 1-yard carries. He's going to do it with 4 or 5 12-yard carries and some 7-yard carries, and he's going to make people feel it when he does it. He's not the straight-line hammer that he's kind of been made out to be, but he's a load, and he's a super freakishly athletic load. And at this point in time, you're looking around at this team on this offense going, okay, who's the game changer? Who's the trump card is the word that Sigmund Bloom from Football Guys uses. Who's the trump card on the offense?
Mm-hmm.
For a long time, it was Dez Bryant. Dez Bryant goes down. Okay, we still have Tony Romo. He's the trump card now. Okay, Tony Romo goes down. Who's the trump card? is it Jason Witten who runs like a dad? Is it is it body catcher over there? Is it Devin Street who, yeah, you know, is it the Shetland ponies pretty good? Is it is it Lance Dunbar? I don't know if you.
I think right now the only answer is Lance Dunbar.
It's Lance Dunbar and it's the offensive line. The offensive line hasn't been playing that well, so I'm looking for, and maybe this is just my philosophy, I want as many trump cards. I want as many guys that the other team can't match as possible. And the one guy that you kind of look around the offensive meeting room and go, hey, this guy might be it, and we haven't really seen it yet, is Christian Michael. And so maybe we're hyping him up too much. He may wind up to be nothing, but we've heard nothing but good things about him running the scout team. He's been very effective, according to all reports, running the scout team, and very impressive. And me personally, 3 weeks in with no other trump cards on the offense right now, I want to see if that guy can be it. Because if we get 14 games of the highest upside of Christian Michael, this team can do a lot better than what we were planning on them doing over the course of the next 8 games, and could really, really, really put themselves in a good position for the playoffs with a fresh quarterback who doesn't have a lot of reps under him and all that other kind of stuff that will happen towards the end of the year. So.
Speaking of trump cards, you know, we were just talking about how a lot of those cards in the deck are no longer in our hand anyway. So, in their absence, I guess my question is, what do you think, or if you're Scott Linehan, put your offensive coordinator's hat on for a second, what are you going to do to attack other teams' defenses? What are you doing to attack the Falcons? What are you doing in the next month or two to try to generate offense when you don't have those kind of obvious mismatch possibilities at your disposal?
Well, I think the thing that's interesting about this team is you don't have, like I said, the trump card, the guy that completely changes everything, but you have some very effective chess pieces. And guys that if you use them correctly can be extremely effective. And I'm talking about guys like Cole Beasley, who was the one getting the double teams against the Eagles, by the way. And you're talking about Lance Dunbar, who's on pace for like a 950-yard receiving season or something like that. And you talk about a guy like Terrence Williams with the run after the catch. And that's the thing that you look around at. We said it a few years ago, is that this team had nobody other than Dez Bryant who could run after the catch. And they had Cole Beasley and Lance Dunbar sitting over there deep, and I'm sitting here yelling, you got to get Cole Beasley the ball, you got to get Lance Dunbar the ball, and everybody's trying to cut him because they're small. And I'm saying these guys do stuff that nobody else on the team does, and now we've seen them have a chance to do it. And to me, that's what you have to do at this point. You have to simplify the game for Brandon Whedon, not because he's not a capable quarterback from a mental standpoint, but just because – there are certain guys that the longer they hold on to the ball, the more excited you get. Guys like Tony Romo, guys like Aaron Rodgers, Andrew Luck even. The longer they hold the ball, there's a very good likelihood that something really awesome is going to happen. And then there's guys on the other end of that spectrum, and that's Jay Cutler and Matt Stafford. And at this point in time, I'm kind of putting Brandon Whedon in that second category. I don't want him to have the ball in his hands for a long time with a chance to have to read through 5 pieces of a progression and come back and make a decision. I want to simplify the game for him as much as possible. I want to get the ball out of his hand as soon as his foot hits the ground. Because when he drops back, bang, 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 foot in the ground, ball comes out. We saw it on Sunday. Perfect strike on the slant route to Terrence Williams, and he outruns everybody for a touchdown. And there's no reason why you can't do that 2 or 3 more times over the course of the next 8 games. And there's no reason why he can't bang Cole Beasley on an option route coming inside and let Cole Beasley make some runs. I think you want to throw the ball on inward breaking routes. You want to simplify the offense, get the ball out quick. And again, I'm talking about Christian Michael. I want to find a guy I can hand the ball to that's going to be dynamic with the ball in his hands. And I beat the drum for Joseph Randle throughout the course of the year of the offseason. And I'll continue to say that I think he's more than capable of being the lead. The chairman of the committee is kind of the term that Mike Fisher started to use for that. And I feel like he's more than capable of carrying that role. unless there's a guy like Christian Michael who comes along and just takes it from him. And so you got to find a way to give the ball to guys and make an impact there. And you got to get the ball out quick. You want to run slant routes. You want to run shallow crossing routes. Get guys the ball on the move. You got to find a way to let Gavin Escobar test the seams of a defense. We've seen him do that with Tony Romo throwing him the ball. You got to find a way to do it with Brandon Weeden throwing him the ball. And you got to have a guy, you got to take a shot or two. Brandon Weeden's a good deep ball thrower. He's got a great arm. You hear Jerry Poppins bragging about it throughout the course of the week on the radio. And he throws a pretty ball. So you got to give him a chance. Get Terrence Williams going down the field. Get Bryce Butler in his 4-3-7 running down the field. And see if you can get down the field on these guys and make a play down the field and loosen up the defense to make it easier for you to do all the stuff underneath that you want to do.
It seems like one of the most important things they've got to do in the next game or two is to get some tape for the rest of the league's defensive coordinators to see of someone getting deep so that that threat exists, even if they don't do it every game. I think the key is that threat because, they have so many guys who can operate underneath with great effectiveness. If they can just back the safeties off a little bit, I think they'll have some room to manage.
Absolutely. And maybe it's Lance Dunbar went deep twice in the game. And got open twice, made a catch on one, and Tony overthrew him on the other. But maybe it's Dunbar. Maybe it's
Butler.
Maybe it's Butler. I mean, we've seen Williams do it. You got to find a guy that can get down the field just to keep that free safety, that two extra steps back in the middle of the field to give you a little extra, those windows a little bit bigger there underneath.
So the last question we've got basically is, you know, when we're dealing with Atlanta, can they use the same, concepts that they use in Philly? I mean, is there a part of the playbook that Weeden simply can't manage?
I don't think there is. I don't think there's plays that you can't run with Brandon Weeden. He can make every throw on the field. He's a capable mentally stable quarterback. He can make the right decisions. I read somewhere today, this is the first time in his career since the seventh grade that he's had the same offensive coordinator.
I saw that too.
Or play caller. That's for crazy. 2 years in a row. That is insane. The guy's like 31 years old. You're what, 13 when you're in seventh grade? This is the first time in 18 years. Granted, he played some baseball for a few years. So it's the first time in 13 years of football since he was 13 years old that he's had the same guy calling plays and running the offense 2 years in a row. So you got to think that he's got some benefit from the – I mean, you guys talk about continuity as much as anybody and the benefits of that. So I think you're going to see some of that. I think he's had time to master the entire offense. He's physically capable of handling the entire offense. I think the thing that you pull back a little bit is the art of the quarterbacking, so to speak. And that's what Tony Romo does as well as anybody has in a long time. And that's get to the line of scrimmage. That's one of the things people worry all the time about. Why does he let it go down to 1 second? And there's a lot of reasons for that. We don't have to get into that. But I don't think you'll see that quite as much with Brandon Weeden because I don't think he's going to want to do as much tinkering at the line of scrimmage. I think he's going to go up. If I'm Scott Linehan, I'm calling either a run play to the left and a run play to the right or a run and a pass in the huddle, and I'm giving Brandon the opportunity to if the numbers are right, you run the ball. If they're not right, you throw it. You kill the play and you throw it.
The interesting thing about that is I kind of think after just watching the game tape for the last 2 weeks that might just help the offense overall. I started to wonder, if maybe simplifying things, especially at least until the offensive line can start getting a little bit of continuity back and get healthy, it may just help the offense in general to run kind of how do I rephrase this? The thing that makes Tony great is what you're describing. The ability to be the coach on the field, the guy that can look at the defense, adjust, and can completely change the play to take advantage of what he sees. But maybe like it will help how the offense runs to simplify it and strip the playbook down a little bit to what Weeden can just, very simply call a play. So there's less things for the offense overall to have to think about. I mean, if you go look at Philly, they shot themselves in the foot with pre-snap penalties, and you have to wonder if part of that is just Romo cycling through calls and changing the play all the time. And sometimes maybe it's just better to go up, line up, and just play ball.
Yeah, I mean – it's always funny because the point that you make is valid, in that maybe it's just better, and it's funny because it's the way this defense plays.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe it's just better to go out there and line up and not be in pursuit there, not be in pursuit of the perfect play or the perfect scheme, but just one that's good enough. Because and there's a fine line there. That's why I called it the art of quarterbacking whenever I was talking about it, because it's the art of, okay, I see this play. I see the defense doing this. I mean, Tony against New York, it was brilliant. I mean, he's sitting there, the slot corner's 8 yards off the line of scrimmage, and he's looking up, calling Jason Witten back into the core of the formation, pointing to the slot corner and say, here he comes. And then ball snapped, and here comes the corner. I mean, it's masterful what he's doing at the line of scrimmage, but maybe from a mechanic standpoint and from building some momentum standpoint and things like that, maybe you're right. Maybe it's good for him. One of the things Drew Brees is really good about is tempo in and out of the huddle. Mm-hmm. So they get in the huddle. He calls a play. They get out of the huddle, ready, break. They get up to the line of scrimmage. He starts his signals, and they go. And every once in a while, he'll check. He'll stop. If it's a bad play that they're in, he's going to get them out of it. But if it's an okay play, he's not necessarily in pursuit of the perfect play. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very, very fine line. It's an artistic thing. Different quarterbacks have different preferences. But I think Tony's just reached this point where he's this master of this offense that he's played in for 7 or 8 years now. And he understands defenses well enough, and he understands tendencies, and he understands these things so well that he sees something. And if you're Peyton Manning, for example, and I'm going to stretch it a little bit here. If you're Peyton Manning and you look at a defense and you know, I know exactly what this defense is about to do, and I know the exact right play call that's the perfect play call to get us in, and I know the exact right protection that I need us to be in, of course you're going to do it. Of course you're going to put them in the protection and call the right route, call the route combination at the line of scrimmage. But if you're Brandon Weeden and you know, okay, well, this looks like it could be this, are you better off just going ahead and running what the coach has called and making sure everybody's on the same page and that you don't overthink it? Or that you don't guess wrong whenever you don't know for sure. I mean, it's a super thin line. It's a super abstract subject, and it's one that you never really know the exact right answer, because there are benefits to both sides. And you're right, the mechanical penalties and things like that took place in the Eagles game, that looked very, very far from a Jason Garrett coach team. But who knows? We just got to hope that they figure out a way to get the guy to the line of scrimmage, get the play called, and get him rolling.
You know, you were just talking about the Eagles game, but I'd actually like to refer us back to the Giants game for a second, if we could, because, you know, this idea of you know, the sort of masterful quarterback. Let's take Weeden out of the equation just for a second and talk about the offensive tempo and pace. You know, the masterful quarterback who can, and I think the example you gave from the Giants game is a great example, where he changed the protection. Witten came in, picked up the blitzer off the corner, and Romo was able to make the play. But the other time when Romo's advantage in terms of his kind of intellectual advantage was most evident, of course, was in the final two fourth quarter drives. And where it's evident then is his ability to process information compared to the ability to process information on the other side of the ball for, like, the Giants' young rookie middle linebacker, for example, who was not able to keep up during those last two drives. And, you know, they had, what, 11 completions, and I think probably 8 of them were against that poor kid.
Right.
You know, and so in some ways, when you let the clock run down to 1, you give that guy an opportunity to catch up that he doesn't have if you don't give him any time.
Right.
When you have a quarterback like that. And so part of me feels like, while I appreciate everything Romo's doing, and I think it is "quote unquote" Peyton Manning-esque, part of me wonders is if what you do is you allow the defense a chance to get caught up, and they get set, and they're at their best every time as well. And so I felt like last year we saw a little bit less of that. There was more just kind of getting to the line, snapping the ball, running a play, and there was like in that New Orleans game and some of those other games, there was a kind of offensive momentum that built, where the Saints were always playing catch up. They were on their heels for the better part of the game. And I feel like that's been lost this year. And I don't know if that we can ever regain it with Weeden behind center, but I feel like that's something that I would like to see glimpses of, because I don't know. I feel like the offense is somehow not keeping the defense on its heels thus far, and I think that that's something we need to see if they're going to be effective, I guess.
Right, right. And the thing about the thing that's interesting about the comparison, and you said it's Peyton Manning-like, and I extended the tangent that direction. But the thing that's different about the way that Peyton Manning's doing it or has done it throughout his career is he's done it without a huddle.
Right.
So there is that kind of consistent momentum of, even though he's standing at the line of scrimmage and making adjustments and things like that, is that the defense doesn't get a break. Because the thing about Peyton and the thing about being at the line of scrimmage is you could decide to snap the ball at any point. That's what people talk about. Well, you got to, if you wait till 1 second left on the clock, they know when you're going to snap the ball. And A, try being a defensive lineman with Tyron Smith standing in front of you and try to look at the clock that's 80 yards away. You're not doing that, first of all. But second of all,
please do that. Please try to look at the please do that,
because this offensive line's gonna
Vic Beasley. I encourage this behavior.
yes.
Exactly. But the thing is that if you know that they're doing that, or you know that they think that you're waiting to 1 second every time, all you got to do is quick snap them on it,
right?
At 6 seconds, two or three times, and they're done. Then they've got to be on their toes the whole time. You're going to catch them on. You know what I mean? You catch them on their heels two or three times, and they have to change the way that they're preparing for you. So when you do it without a huddle, you give yourself the ability to do that. And I think that you're right. I think that one of the things that's happened this year in the two games, there's been two really weird games. I mean, with the turnover situation and the 4 2-minute drives in the Giants game and settling for field goals early in the game and things like that, you really haven't felt like this team really had the momentum going offensively. It's exactly like you said, and they haven't had the chance to build that, because it's first down and 10 and they run the ball for 8 yards, and all of a sudden it should be second and 2 and flag comes out and it's holding and it's second and 14. Mm-hmm. And now you got to line up, and now you got to run two pretty close to perfect plays, because you got to get 15 yards in 3 downs instead of getting 10 yards in 3 downs, which is hard enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so you put yourself in these situations to have to make these adjustments to try to get to the perfect play, to try to get this extra yardage, or to try to make up for the block that was missed, or those sorts of things. So I think that they're just – the offense just isn't at the point this year to where they were. And the funny thing is we're comparing them to where they were by the end of last year.
Right.
Where and maybe the middle is probably a better comparison, but – the offense really, I mean, wasn't like stupendously clicking last year until kind of that New Orleans game, the Seahawks game. We remember the Titans game, and all they did was just run the ball straight down their throat second.
But we were surprised too.
Right. We were shocked. Oh, yeah.
We didn't know that we were gonna be able to run the ball all over.
Exactly. We saw glimpses of it against San Francisco. They averaged 5 yards a carry against San Francisco, and then they turn around against Tennessee. And they just jammed the ball down their throats and said, stop it whenever you decide to.
Yeah.
And they never could. And they continued to do that throughout the rest of the year. And as that confidence built up, the momentum built from game to game, too. It wasn't just from play to play and series to series. It was they had that game against Tennessee, and it was almost like they looked around at each other and said, well, we knew we wanted to run it, but holy crap, we can really run it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just started going. And so Tony get to the line of scrimmage, and he quick snap them and hand the ball to Murray, and away they go. And they just haven't gotten there yet. And which is funny, because Tony got more offseason work this year than he's had in several years. And they're just not to that point yet offensively. And it may not be until week 13 or so until we see that. But hopefully they're this has been talked about ad nauseum. Hopefully they're able to hold it together, right the ship enough through the course of the next 7 games, and be able to get the cavalry back in time to be able to play the way that they want to play going down the stretch.
Well, I tell you what, I look forward to talking to you, you know, when check in sometime later in the season and seeing how this all plays out. Listen, everybody, please check out Joey and his fine, fine work, both on Cowboys HQ and at Bleacher Report. He's one of the great follows on Twitter. It's at Joey Ikes, J-O-E-Y-I-C-K-E-S. Joey, please come back and join us again, will you?
Absolutely, guys. Anytime.
Thanks so much, man. Thanks for joining us.
Great stuff from Joey. It's good to have him back, and it's not really Cowboys football season until we've had a chance to talk X's and O's with Joey.
I agree. I've said many a time my football fantasy is to sit there with a beer and Joey on the whiteboard and talk X's and O's. He's the best. I'll tell you what. Let's bring Gina Thomas from the Falcoholic in, and we'll talk about the Atlanta Falcons early season.
Welcome Gina Thomas in from the Falcoholic. Gina, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming on. And Gina is a freelance writer. She also works in digital content distribution and international rights management, serving as an editor-in-chief at the Falcoholic, which, by the way, is one of my very favorite SB Nation titled websites, where she produces a wide variety of posts, as well as the land-grant Holy Land SB Nation's Ohio State football site. With both teams undefeated, she's having a pretty good season so far.
Yes. Well, yes, I am.
Well, welcome again. And let's go ahead and kind of set the stage for where the Falcons are. Since we don't get to see you guys every season, it's good to kind of get reestablish where these teams are. So in the offseason, the Falcons fired Mike Smith and hired former Seahawks defensive coordinator Dan Quinn. So tell us about the Quinn administration. Since Atlanta is 2-0, I'm assuming the early returns are favorable. What has he done to reshape the team in his image?
Well, the main thing that he has done is Dan Quinn has brought a completely different energy and attitude to Flowery Branch. He's a really positive person. He's really high energy. The pace of practice is very different. Everything is very fast. Quinn and the coaching staff, they get in there and they do drills with the players. I mean, they're really involved. Dan Quinn spends time after practice working one-on-one with on technique with practice squad guys, which is something that is relatively unusual at this level, I believe. So he just is... He's very invested. He's very engaged. He's very focused on teaching. He's very positive. And it's just a completely different energy there. And it's something that the players have really bought into. You can tell a difference in the locker room as well.
So as Landon mentioned in his first question, Quinn was formerly the Seahawks defensive coordinator. So as such, you know, we assume that he's going to bring the Seahawks defensive philosophy to Atlanta with him. So tell us about the Falcons' defensive makeover in terms of both scheme and personnel. And a little follow-up, what should the crippled Cowboys offense expect to see from Quinn's and, I guess, you know, technically nominal defensive coordinator Richard Smith's guys on Sunday?
Okay, well, the main thing that's different about this scheme is that it's very, very simple compared to Mike Nolan's defensive scheme. Different players have told me that with Nolan's scheme, you were thinking through five different elements of what you needed to do even before the snap. And it was just a lot to think about. It didn't really allow them to just react to what was happening on the field. The scheme now is fast, and it's very simple, and it's essentially, you know, see ball, get ball. They're going to attack the ball. They're going to play physical. They're going to try to stop the run. They're going to try to disrupt Brandon Whedon. And so those are really the main things that you can expect. In terms of personnel, they've added actually quite a few people since the last time we played the Cowboys. Vic Beasley was their first-round draft pick. Mm-hmm. He has really looked extraordinary. He's really getting up to speed very quickly. He's improved from college in terms of his run defense, and he's just so quick off the snap. He is really a remarkable player. I think he's going to really develop into a very special player. Adrian Claiborne was an offseason acquisition. They actually bounced him inside to tackle, which I didn't expect, but he's flourishing in that position. He's another guy who's really quick off the snap and really disruptive. O'Brien Schofield, he's kind of been a journeyman. He's a veteran. He has got some arthritis issues in his knee that kind of limit his ability to be on the field for long stretches, but he's been getting into the backfield with regularity. And one of the guys to kind of keep an eye on that I think, you know, Brandon Whedon could pick on a little bit. Ricardo Allen was a cornerback, fifth round pick out of Purdue, and he was he's converted to free safety. And so it's a new position for him. He has adapted to it really well. He's got great speed, and actually he does definitely have the range to play the position. But because it's a new position, there are going to be some lapses. I mean, it's just the way that it is. So that is a player to kind of keep an eye on. I do think that that's one thing that Whedon could look for in terms of matchups to exploit.
If you could just do me a favor, my pet cat before the draft was Grady Jarrett. The Cowboys and Falcons actually, you know, the way you're describing it, run a very, very similar system. I think are looking for the same kind of players or the same kind of traits, especially in the front seven, you know. And so obviously you guys got Grady Jarrett, but he was the guy that I really, really wanted in the second or third round in that kind of range. So can you just help me out here and give me a little bit of a sense of how he's doing?
Well, especially since he fell so far in the draft, I was really surprised that the Falcons were able to get him when they did. He was a steal. He is, you know, a little bit undersized, but he, much like his father, who was a legendary Falcons linebacker, Jesse Tuggle, you know, people told Jesse Tuggle he'd never play middle linebacker at this level, and he came in and excelled. And I think that Grady has that ability too. He's a really hard worker. He's very intelligent. So he's picked up the scheme very quickly. He's settled in very nicely, and he's very fast and he's very aggressive. So he looked really good in preseason. And I really think that he will be able to have an impact in a rotational role this season. I'm sure that doesn't make you feel better.
No, but you know, I'll watch on Sunday. You know, with it could have been in my head.
All right, so let's look at the other side of the ball. This is what we know about the Falcons' offense. Matt Ryan will be throwing to a cadre of big, athletic wideouts. What are we missing? And how do you anticipate that ex-Redskins OC Kyle Shanahan will try to attack the Cowboys' defense?
Well, one thing that I know the Falcons will try to do is establish the run. And you guys have a really stout defense. It's not going to be an easy task. And Atlanta's first string running back is going to be out. He has a cracked rib. That's not confirmed yet, but I don't know how he's going to play with a fractured rib. And I saw Tevin Coleman today in the locker room, and he was walking very gingerly. I truly do not expect him to play on Sunday. So Devontae Freeman is a very, very good young running back. And he's actually great at catching passes out of the backfield also. So they could get something going with Devontae. Beyond Devontae, they've got an undrafted free agent, Terran Ward, who is not the same level of running back. So it really is going to mostly be on Devontae in terms of the run game. Another guy to keep an eye on is Jacob Tammy, who has great chemistry with Matt Ryan and had a great game against the Giants. So he is another guy to kind of keep an eye on. I do think that they'll try to keep getting him involved because he's had so much success over these first 2 weeks.
And tell me a little bit, if you can, about the Falcons' remade offensive line. How's that project working out thus far?
You know, remarkably well. I am genuinely surprised. I was very, very confused throughout the preseason when they hadn't really settled on a starting five. And then right before the season started, they cut the guy that everyone expected to be the starting center, Joe Hawley. And then they brought in Andy LaVitra from the Titans and put him at guard. And it's just like that unit needs some continuity and they need the opportunity to develop chemistry and to have that communication in place and be comfortable with each other. They certainly didn't have time to develop that. They have honestly performed so well in spite of that. So I've been genuinely impressed. That was my biggest concern going into week one, and they have truly impressed me.
Well, speaking of impressive, in the last couple of weeks, Atlanta has scored wins over two of our NFC East rivals. Thank you so much. We really appreciate that.
You're welcome. It was our pleasure.
Ours too.
Believe me, it was ours as well. So if you could, just tell us a little bit about what the Falcons did to pull out both those victories in what ended up being two very closely fought games. And what early tells did those games offer about the 2015 edition of your beloved Falcons?
Well, I think that the main thing that the Falcons did was they finished. And that's not necessarily something this team has done over the previous two seasons. And that's why they have had the records that they've had in 2013 and 2014. Some of it, too, was just getting lucky. Ricardo Allen, the free safety that I mentioned earlier, he had a remarkable pick to end the Philadelphia game, and that's the reason the Falcons were able to win. And then last week, they just really gutted it out. I mean, they made the plays that they needed to make. They didn't quit. They didn't give up. And so I think that really that's something that Dan Quinn has emphasized and the coaching staff has stressed throughout this preseason and OTAs, that they were going to be a team that finished on the field. And they certainly have done that these first 2 weeks. As far as tells, I think that the main things that we've learned about this team is that, you know, they are certainly improved. I think that they're definitely improved on both sides of the ball. I love the new schemes. I think the guys are settling in really well. I also think that we have definitely seen that there is a lot of room for improvement. And I don't think that that's surprising or a negative thing necessarily. But, you know, there is certainly a ways to go in terms of establishing the run. And in terms of the defense, you know, actually disrupting the passer, actually, you know, getting sacks. That's something that they've really not been able to do much. So, and then they had some lapses in coverage last week. Missed tackles have been a bit of an issue. So I think that the main thing that we've learned is that there's still a long way to go for this team, even though we have already seen so much improvement.
All right. So final question, and we're going to put you on the spot right here and ask for a game prediction. Who wins on Sunday and why?
Okay. Well, you guys are missing, and I feel these losses acutely myself because my fantasy team is suffering also. And I know that's not the same thing, but, you know, without Dez, without Tony Romo, I've got a lot of Browns fans in my family who watched Whedon play for a long time. I think that the Falcons will be able to pull off another close win, and I think that it will be a high-scoring game. Pretty high scoring. I'm going to say 31-28 Falcons.
That's fair.
There you have it, folks. There you have it.
Well, guys, make sure that you check out Gina and her site, The Falcoholic. It is just like a tongue twister to say, but I love it so much. The Falcoholic, www.thefalcoholic.com. And make sure you follow her on Twitter. That's at Gina Thomas. That's at JEANNATHOMAS for all your Falcons updates. Gina, thank you so much for coming on. And please, please come back on next time we face you guys, will you?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much, Gina.
Another great one in the books, Rabble. What do we got going on next week?
Well, hopefully we're going to have another great one for the books, my friend.
I hope so.
Next week, we're going to have one of our newer BTB front page writers, Danny Phantom. He's a youngster that shows a lot of promise, and he'll be on the show to discuss the Cowboys-Falcons game. And then we'll welcome Kevin Skyver from Canal Street Chronicles, SB Nation's New Orleans Saints site, to preview the Cowboys' upcoming Sunday night visit to the Big Easy. Should be a good one.
That was quite a tongue twister. Before we go, I want to make sure that we are plugging Blogging the Boys. Blogging the Boys is the only place to go for all your Cowboys info. BloggingTheBoys.com has all your information post-game, pre-game, during the game. Dude, you got to follow Blogging the Boys during the game. Go to the comment section and follow the thread. It's just too much fun. Make sure you check them out on Facebook, Blogging the Boys, and on Twitter at Blogging the Boys. And until next week, happy trails, everybody.
Happy trails, y'all.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. prayers to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together?